Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Garth Nix, who writes books for young adults, whose most recent books are Mr. Monday and Grim Tuesday, part of the Keys to the Kingdom young adult books.
You can get too hung up on categories, I think. I write books for young adults and for children. Young adult books are really adult books that are particularly attractive or appropriate for teenagers and upwards, whereas children's books are for, you know, younger than teens. But, of course, there's incredible overlap between these categories.
Is Keys to the Kingdom, is that a children's book or a young adult?
I think they're children's fantasies. And in my mind, I think they're for sort of, you know, 8 or 9 upwards. But I don't think there should be an upper limit on children's books, because I think good children's books, good young adult books, are also for adults. And if they are good books, then they'll work for anyone. But there probably does need to be a sort of entry-level age where, you know, you need to... You know, parents, obviously, it's helpful for to know roughly, whether the book's appropriate for their children. Though, of course, the best way is for them to read it themselves.
Which is pretty good if the books are fun.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I read lots. I mean, I'm a parent, even though my son's very young. I'm not reading for him as yet, but I read lots of children's books and amongst my other reading. And I think, you miss out if you say, I'm not going to read these books or I'm not going to read those books.
Well, these books are fantasy mostly. You said you have one science fiction novel?
Yeah, Shades Children is my one science. You know, it's a near future, sort of post-apocalyptic dystopian novel, so that's much more down the science fiction end of the road. But fantasy is much more sort of my cup of tea, I think.
Garth Nix, what prompted you to write books for young adults, kids' books, as opposed to adult books?
Again, it's this question of categorisation, because books like Sabriel, for instance, which is published as a young adult novel here, is also published as an adult fantasy novel in Australia and in other parts of the world. So I actually wrote it as I wrote all my books just for myself, and then it was sort of up to the publishers to decide where it went. And I think, you know, again, with a lot of young adult genre novels, you know, often they can be published as adult novels or for young adults. But I love children's fantasy. I mean... you know, I was very much influenced by people like Ursula Le Guin, Lloyd Alexander, the British writer Alan Garner, Susan Cooper, tons of great writers, T.H. White. You know, I could actually probably just sit here reciting a list of authors.
Sure.
And I think when I got started, I just wanted to write the sort of book that I love to read. And they were among my favourite books, were children's books and specifically children's fantasy.
The Seven Tower books and Sabriel books take place in a different universe.
Yes.
Whereas Keys to the Kingdom takes place, or at least starts, more or less in a future version of ours.
Yeah, it's partly in a sort of very near future version of any Western country, really. It could be America or Australia or the UK. And, you know, it doesn't matter where it is because it has those similarities. And then of course, it moves to... to this a fantasy world, essentially, but a different sort of fantasy world than is often portrayed in these books. I've actually always loved books that started in their real world and then something happens or, you know, you find, you know, the passage through the wardrobe or whatever and you can get into another fantasy world. In fact, my very first book, The Rag Witch, which is being re-released this year, I think, here in the US, is that kind of book. I wanted to write a sort of harder-edged Narnia book. I wanted to sort of write a gritty Narnia book. And I think I've come, you know, with The Keys to the Kingdom quite a lot later, I've come back to that idea again where, you know, because I like that idea of you never know what might happen. You know, this is your normal life in your normal city and so on, but there could be all this other amazing stuff about to happen.
As I was reading Keys to the Kingdom, Mr. Monday and Grim Tuesday, I kept thinking of Roger Zelazny's Amber books.
That shows the depth of your reading, I think, because you're the first person who's mentioned it, but you're absolutely right. I love those books, and I'm sure that they've been an influence upon these. And, of course, there's other people in Zelazny who postulate an idea that somewhere there is, you know, a sort of epicenter of the universe when everything else is just, you know, a copy or a
shadow.
You know, a shadow in his books, of course. Mine's a little bit different, but there's certainly an influence from Zelazny there, and... you know, I loved his Amber novels and other novels as well. I mean, I think he was a tremendous writer.
The other connection there is the god of the kingdom, or goddess of the kingdom, the architect, has somehow disappeared, much like Oberon in the Amber books.
Oh,
as well.
I hadn't thought of that, but that's an interesting connection. And I think if, you know, if a sort of a literary forensic scientist went through all my books, they would find, you would actually be able to work out, you know, what I've read.
There's a list of books of authors that influenced you, and, you know, I'm looking, and I thought, okay, Demon Prince novels by Jack Vance,
yep.
And, you know, it's yep. all there.
Yeah, well, when I love Jack Vance's work, and certainly, you know, I wish I could write as elegantly as he does. You know, I mean, his prose, you know, is both characteristic and tremendous, and also just his invention, you know. I mean, but yeah, there's so many. I mean, I'm sure, I think all authors are a product of their reading. I've, you know, absorbed other things as well from all sorts of sources and then been able to make my own stories. But, you know, I think that, of course, there are similarities.
Let's talk a little bit about Keys to the Kingdom and where it differs from your other works. The others, from what I've seen here, are all for a slightly older age group. Now, when you were writing this, that didn't play into it until at what point? When you gave it to the publisher?
The Seventh Tower books were written for much the same audience, the Seventh Tower series, but Sabriel, Lyrel of Horsen, and Shade's Children are written for, you know, for that young adult, you know, crossover to adult audience. Now, I intended to write these books for a slightly, I wanted the entry level to be younger, even though, again, I hope that they'll be read by teenagers, adults as well. And that was just what I wanted to do next. In terms of sort of publishing common sense, I probably should have just written another Old Kingdom novel, because that trilogy is by far, you know, they're my most successful and most well-known books all around the world. And people are always emailing me and writing to me saying, you know, write another one. But I actually wanted to do something different. It actually, the idea for it just came to me while I was actually finishing Abhorsen. The names of the seven books and the seven characters just popped into my head, and I wrote them in my notebook. And I didn't know who they were or what they meant. But then over when I was finishing Abhorsen, as I think is the case with many authors, I was also thinking about the next book, because, you know, you're always keen to get on to the next work. And I gradually worked out, you know, who these people were. You know, who was Mr. Monday? You know, who was Grim Tuesday? It just seemed to naturally become a children's fantasy rather than a young adult or an adult fantasy. But I can't explain how that happened. My stories always seem to find their own level. They just come out at a certain level, and I can't explain why or how.
Well, Garth Nix, let's talk a little about that. Do you just start writing a first draft and see where it goes? Is it plotted out in advance? How do you work?
I actually think about things. I think about a book normally for at least a year or so before I actually write a line of the book. And I'll make notes. I'll make lots of notes as things pop into my head. And normally I write a chapter outline as well, though the chapter outline is sometimes written after I've written, you know, the first chapter or the prologue or whatever. And the chapter outline is never corresponds with the finished book. It's kind of like I make a roadmap for myself of landmarks,
and then
I'd go a different way.
Right.
But I like to have it to go back to if I get lost, you know, so I can say, well, this is what I planned, but, you know, I've actually gone somewhere else, but I still want to use those things from the outline. And as I'm writing the books, I also continue to make notes about what's going to happen in, you know, in this book and in the next book and so on. So, you know, it's a sort of a slow process where things build up inside my head and I'm making notes about them, and the whole story is sort of washing around in both my conscious and subconscious, I'm sure. And then at some point, you know, which might be a year after the initial, you know, ideas have been recorded in my notebook, I'll sit down and I'll write the first, you know, the first line of the first chapter or whatever. And sometimes I write a chapter and then I don't write anything for 6 months, and then I start and keep on going.
I assume Wednesday's finished by now.
It's not quite finished. It should be finished, but it's not. I'm actually behind schedule, I'm sorry to say. Books sometimes, they don't proceed as planned, and you know, you find yourself backtracking and changing, or you know, just they take longer to come out.
So at this point, Wednesday is not quite finished, but you must have notes on Thursday and Friday.
Yeah, I've got notes for all of the books.
And you know it ends.
I know how it ends. I actually nearly always know how my books end. In fact, I always know how they end. Even though I don't know the details as a rule, I always have a good idea of the nature of the ending or the emotional effect of the ending, and the details sort of arise, you know, as I go through the book. So, yes, I know the overall story of the Keys to the Kingdom, but I don't know the details in between, which, of course, is what makes it interesting for me as well.
When you're working with kids, and you know kids are going to read this, they're not as forgiving as adults when it comes to inconsistencies and errors. How do you deal with that?
Good editors. I actually think readers in general deserve to have, you know, an accurate text. And, of course, it is much more difficult in a series like The Keys to the Kingdom or The Seventh Tower where, you know, I'm writing it as I go, and, of course, the books are out there, so you can't retrospectively, you know, change right. things or adjust them. But I try and be as careful as I can be to be consistent. And, of course, you know, editors do find things as well. There is a very in The Seventh Tower, actually, there is a minor error of continuity in one of the books, which I think was fixed in later printings. That's the only one that I know of. It's nothing major. It doesn't affect any of the major characters. It's just, and very few people have noticed it. But it annoys me that it's still, you know, that it was there. But I guess all you can do is, you know, is be, you know, true to your story and hope that, you know, if there are any inconsistencies, they'll be picked up before the book's published.
Did you hear that J.K. Rowling plans to, when she's done with all of the books, go back and revise them to make them consistent?
I hadn't heard that, actually, and I'm surprised by that. I mean, I would never do that, to be honest. I mean, unless there were glaring inconsistencies, which were driving me crazy, but I would not want to go back to a book and do a revised, you know, a very revised edition of it, because to me that book, you know, was created in its own time and it belongs as it was created, you know. And I know other authors do go back and will do quite revised editions, you know, 20 years after or, right. or whatever. And I have to say, I don't understand that psychology. To me, they have a life of their own once they're out there. And for good or ill, that's what they are. The fledgling has left the nest, you know. It can't come back for cosmetic surgery, you know.
You're listening to an interview with Garth Nix, whose most recent books are Mr. Monday and Grim Tuesday, part of the Keys to the Kingdom septology?
Yeah, I guess you could call it a septology.
When they finally are all come out. One thing I notice about a lot of these children's books, young adult books, J.K. Rowling, Philip Pullman, and perhaps underneath the surface a little bit of Garth Nix, there's a certain subversive nature to all of them. They're turning organized religion and turning societal values on their head.
Pullman, of course, is very overt about his religious views, and, of course, the third book in the series is very overt. I don't have that sort of agenda. I just want to tell a good story, but, of course, you can't help but infuse stories with, you know, your own philosophies and so on. I guess with my books, there's always a certain sort of level of sort of humour, of sort of sardonic humour, which is looking at society and so on. So, I mean, I do poke fun at things, and in The Keys to the Kingdom, I'm, you know, making fun of some things, and I'm also looking at some, you know, sort of philosophical ideas and so on. But they're very subservient to the story. I want to tell a good story. That's my primary motivation. And if there's other stuff there as well, that's good. I mean, I think it's good to have more than just the top level of the story. But I'm not setting out to achieve any particular conversion or otherwise.
So in your case, it'll be there, but it's less conscious than, say, Pullman.
Yeah, I'm not trying to make any particular point or evoke any particular philosophy. But of course, my own, you know, you always infuse the books with your own personal beliefs. Mine tend to be, I guess, on a more personal level than on a sort of religious or societal level. You know, there are things like personal responsibility and sort of assuming responsibility and so on, you know, which is, I don't think about it. It's one of those themes that tends to emerge through all my books. I don't know why, and people have pointed it out to me. And I think, well, I guess you're right, you know. You know, but I think it's certainly story is my main objective. I want to tell a ripping yarn, you know. I want to just, a book you can't put down is always my objective. That's one of my favourite things, and, you know, I like to try at least to give that to readers.
Names play an important part in your books. In Grim Tuesday, we have the names of the days of the week. Why? Or is this something that we're going to find out later on?
There's no sort of cosmically deep reason for each of the seven trustees being named after days of the week, but there is an underlying reason in that names have resonance, you know, and they evoke certain, you know, emotions and connections and so on, and that's what I use them for. There are reasons for it within the story, but there's no sort of gigantic sort of metaphysical reason. But I do spend a lot of time working on names. I spend a lot of time on names, either creating the names from particular elements that evoke the sorts of reactions that I want, or in the grand tradition, stealing them from Shakespeare or from the Bible or from, you know, other quarters. So, you know, there's a tremendous amount of source material, you know, in English literature or in translated literature for that matter. And, you know, I'm a jackdaw. I pick pieces from all over the place and try and get the names that I think will work to create the feeling that I want.
So Arthur Penhaligon, Arthur Pendragon.
Yeah, it's an intentional, and of course there I actually, you know, he's not Arthur Pendragon, and in fact he is not, and that, I guess that's me being subversive, because Arthur in fact is not, you know, born to be this great hero. He's actually an accidental hero. He just happened to be about to die from his asthma attack, and he was one of numerous people who could have been chosen by this conscious will to carry out its aims. So in a way, I'm evoking Pendragon, but then at the same time, I'm playing with the idea. So I'm sort of making the connection and then breaking the connection. And similarly, you know, like he's an orphan, which is a staple of children's literature and children's fantasy, but he's been adopted into a happy family, which he thinks of as his own family. So again, I'm taking the stereotype and then twisting it around, which makes it more interesting for me.
When I saw the name Sabriel, I kept thinking, is that some kind of angel or something?
Well, again, I mean, and that name I created by combining the heraldic term for black, which is sable, with the IEL ending. Now, I probably wrote down 150 names before I got in different combinations before I got that name, but I wanted the IEL, you know, ending of, you know, the Hebrew ending for, which is used in angels' names, because I wanted to evoke a feeling of somebody with that sort of power, and a very powerful sounding name. And I practice saying them aloud to see how they work. You know, I think that's quite important.
Well, if you're looking back over your entire work, what names do you think you hit the nail on the head best for?
Well, Sabriel, definitely. I think that worked very well. Abhorsen, which is the name of the third book and is also a title used in Sabriel, was a name I was not happy with initially, and that's one I actually stole from Shakespeare. It's the name of a character in Measure for Measure, an executioner in Measure for Measure, though I changed the spelling very slightly. And I never liked it at the time, but I didn't change it. But over the years, I'm not sure whether I've just got used to it, I've actually thought it does work. The names of the bells, which are used in magic and Sabriel, I spent a long time on the names of those bells, and I think they work very well too.
When you say you spent a long time, what happened? You just sit there with a pen going, ch-ch-ch.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just writing down variations of names in my notebook and not being happy with them, and then leaving them and coming back like a week later and spending another, you know, hour changing names and then doing it again before I even wrote the passage where those names were used. I mean, that's an extreme example because, you know, sometimes a name comes much more quickly, but quite often I'll be working on them off and on for a long time before the name comes right.
Having read a lot of fantasy over the years, I can say that if you choose the wrong name,
yeah, it completely explodes,
destroys
the whole
it.
Thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's a few writers whose work I love apart from the names, and it's very difficult to read the books, even though they're good, because the names are silly.
I think what happens if they're wrong in fantasy or science fiction is you giggle, and that kills it.
Yeah, when the suspension of disbelief is gone in a moment. You know, so that's a reason to work on the names.
Well, does that ever happen when you're actually coming up with an idea? Like, for instance, if suddenly you have the Nifflings, who are these creatures created out of nothing, and they do something so silly that you read it, it's not scary, it's silly.
Well, it's certainly in some of the drafts, you know, I mean, I've had to change things because, you know, it's been borderline where I've just thought, that just doesn't work. And sometimes I'll scrap a chapter and have to write it again because, you know, what I've written doesn't fit into the overall story, or, you know, it sort of does on the surface, but there's something about it that doesn't gel, including, you know, making me laugh or prospectively make readers laugh. And sometimes, of course, it's a fine line. You have to think very carefully about, does this work or not? You know, hopefully I've always made, you know, I've made the right decisions or been helped to, you know, of course, by, you know, the editors at the various publishing houses. That suspension of disbelief is so important. You have to keep the reader within the world of the story. And if there's something that throws them out, whether it's a silly name or something that happens that just doesn't seem right, then the book is lost, really. You know, they've gone from that world.
Do you feel in addition, that as you write, for instance, these books, Mr. Monday, Grim Tuesday, that say whatever the Wednesday book is.
Drowned Wednesday.
Yeah. On some level, it has to top Grim Tuesday.
No, actually. No? Fortunately. that would be very scary if I did that. They're actually quite different books. I mean, they're part of the same overall big story, but the feel and sort of tone of each book is different. Drowned Wednesday, which I'm still working on now, is mostly a sort of nautical adventure. You know, it's got pirates and ships, and so it actually has a completely different feel, and it's quite a different sort of adventure for Arthur as well. There's different sorts of challenges. You know, in the first two books, he's really directly opposed by Mr. Monday and Grim Tuesday, but actually in Drowned Wednesday, he's not directly opposed by Wednesday. There's a different sort of challenge to him. Arthur is different too. I mean, he's growing through the... He's not growing much older through the books, but, you know, day by day.
He's growing.
But he's growing. You know, he's taken on a very big challenge, and that's changing him. You know, I don't want to write the same thing seven times, you know, or the same, exactly really the same structure of story seven times. So, you know, I hope that there'll be enough similarity that, you know, readers... The things they enjoy are still there, but there's new things as well, so they can feel they've got a somewhat different experience with each book.
Which is, from what I've seen, one of the hardest things to do, which is you want your readers to be satisfied, so you have to write something that will be like what you wrote before. So there's a Garth Nix book, yet at the same time, if you write the same book, it's boring for you and boring for them.
Yeah. I mean, it is a great challenge, and in fact, you know, Shade's Children is an interesting example of that, because after I wrote Sabriel, I didn't write the sequel immediately. I wrote Shade's Children, and a lot of people didn't want Shade's Children. They wanted Sabriel again, basically. But I didn't want to do it immediately again. I didn't want to go back to that setting again, or, you know, pick up the threads of that story. I wanted to do something different, so I did. And I think ultimately that is always better. You can have some short-term disadvantages because of that, but I still think it's better to write what you want to write and what you feel is inside you than to return to what, you know, the sort of the market wants. And the readers will forgive you for it, you know, eventually, you know, as long as they get what they want down the track. Or they'll learn to love the other books, you know, the new books.
Garth Nix, something new has happened over the past several years. We hear the names J.K. Rowling, Lemony Snicket, Daniel Handler, Philip Pullman, now Garth Nix. Now, there have always been young adult writers, you mentioned Susan Cooper, certainly, Ursula K. Le Guin. But basically, there's been this new explosion. What do you think is going on? Is there some kind of sea change in kids that suddenly they're reading again? What do you think this is?
I actually doubt whether there's any more reading going on than there used to be. And, of course, you know, there have been authors like, you know, Ursula Le Guin and Jane Yolen and, you know, Susan Cooper. I mean, I think there's always been great authors working in the field and producing, you know, really good books which have been, you know, published and available and so on. But I think the success of Harry Potter, which is, you know, is a social phenomenon, it's, you know, beyond books, anything to do with books, it is a social phenomenon, has made the media and readers so much more aware of fantasy for children and young adults. So actually, I don't think anything's really changed at all in sort of behind the scenes, as it were. I mean, the books are being written, but they get much more attention. You know, they're getting more attention from publishers, from the media, and from the general public. And I think really it is the success of both Harry Potter, you know, which is just this bigger than anything, and probably to a lesser extent Philip Pullman's books, because they're not on the same scale of success, but they've certainly been, I think, very influential, you know, critically and so on. But perhaps the two of them together have just created an arena where there's much more interest at large. But in terms of authors writing books and the sorts of books they're writing, I don't think there's a huge difference, apart from the fact that there's probably a lot of people wanting to write this sort of book now who wouldn't have thought of it before. I think a lot of them are driven by love of this sort of book. I think there's still those people, but I think there's also a new element of people who are driven by, you know, the success of Harry Potter and so on, who think, I can make a quick buck. But I think there's actually fewer of those than we might suspect.
Would you have written all of your books if Harry Potter hadn't existed?
Yeah, well, actually, I wrote most of them. I mean, I wrote many of them well before Harry Potter. So, Sabriel came out in 1995 in Australia, and 1996 was first published here. Shade's Children, Lyrael, they all came out before. Lyrael might have been at the same time as Harry Potter that came out. So I've been, and my first book came out in 1990. So I've been writing children's and young adult fantasy, which is fortunate for me, I think. You know, because I was around, I was doing this sort of stuff, I'm not a bandwagon jumper. I'm not seen to be one either. You know, it's beneficial. I mean, it's funny. I mean, Sabriel, you know, begins with a girl at a boarding school where they teach magic. But I wrote it in 1993, 94, and it was published in 95, which is good for me because I actually think if it came out after Harry Potter, I would have been seen as a tag-along. Harry Potter certainly has been a help. And, you know, I always often think I should perhaps write J.K. Rowling a postcard saying thank you because, I mean, the books were doing quite well and they certainly had their audience.
Sure.
They're at a particular level where they just keep on ticking along and it was all going very nicely. But certainly not not becoming bestsellers, not getting onto, you know, bestseller lists and so on. And I do think that, you know, basically I was paddling my little canoe, you know, and then all of a sudden this tidal wave smashed past me, you know, and kept on going. And then, you know, I was dragged along behind it. So certainly, you know, Harry Potter has been beneficial to people finding my books, you know, and whether they then choose to read them, of course, is a different matter. I do believe the ultimate success of books in the long term always comes to down to word of mouth. It always comes down to the readers. You know, you can be successful briefly with sort of hype and push and so on. The books won't stick around and keep on selling, you know, for years unless there's something worthwhile in the books.
Garth Nix, any word from Hollywood or Peter Jackson on any of these?
Well, I wish there was word from Peter Jackson. I've had ongoing negotiations at various points. But if you're not J.K. Rowling, the only control you have is who you choose to sell the rights to. And because that is the only real control I have, I've been very, very careful. And so far, the right combination of people whose work I respect has not come forward to buy the rights. I'm in a fortunate position where, you know, I don't need to sell them, you know, to make money. I guess in the bottom line, I'd rather have no movie than a bad movie. Because my only choice in decision-making terms is the people that I initially get involved with, I want to try and get involved with the best people I can, you know, before it goes anywhere else. So, you know, I'm hopeful. We'll see what happens.
A couple of more questions about future books. Have you already planned what's going to happen, what kids' books you'll be writing after Keys to the Kingdom?
Yes. Again, I think like most authors, I'm always sort of making notes about other books and so on. I actually am writing very slowly at the same time as I'm writing these, but not with the same sort of focus. A much more complex, large, young adult slash adult science fiction book, which is called A Confusion of Princes, at least that's what it's called at the moment. And it's kind of David Copperfield, the Dickens novel, I hasten to add, sort of combined with Star Wars, I suppose. It's a big space opera.
You've been listening to an interview with Garth Nix, whose books in the Keys to the Kingdom series are Mr. Monday and Grim Tuesday. Drown Wednesday comes out in October. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.